Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of the Chicago Way with Jeff Carlin and me. Yeah, it's December, and it's going to get cold and bleak. Kind of like a Leonard Cohen song you're listening to late at night alone. Something like Famous Blue Raincoat. Your windshield is icing up and the snow's crunching under your feet. But there's a light of an all-night diner on the corner, and inside a waitress behind the counter looks at you and says, "What do you have, hon?" And things start getting better. So we'll try not to be bleak today, although there is some death in it. But it's a happy death for many, not of the left. Fidel Castro, the brutal communist dictator of Cuba, is now burning in hell where he belongs. Talking about Castro today with us will be Gary Marks, the great Tribune investigative reporter who opened the Tribune's Cuba Bureau years ago and later was detained by Castro's intelligence service and then he had to leave the country. First, though, with December comes Christmas, and Christmas time means kids at home, and the family hangs out, and somebody puts on a movie for the family. But what kind of movie? Tribune columnist and editorial board member Christian McQuarrie put up Cujo for her kids. Cujo? Yeah, it's a dog movie, kind of like Jaws was a fish movie. McQuarrie sits in with us first on the Chicago Way. Looking forward to December. Again, children will be coming home again in December. But given that there was a Thanksgiving holiday, I'm wondering if Christian McQuarrie has any tips for us on how to deal with those pesky kids. You too, Jeff. Well, not that they're pesky, because we love them.
Of course. We'll have a lot of laundry detergent ready. Do they come home with piles and piles of laundry? I imagine they do.
They just go in the basement, and their mom, you know, says, "Do what you got to do." She doesn't get involved now.
Yes.
Well, but what do you do with the younger children?
You know, we usually are kind of bouncing around house to house on Christmas. My kids are at an age where they're getting into that point where you can't just get away with getting a few toys. They want technology. They want expensive things. And so, and they're kind of, they know that if they don't still believe really strongly in Santa, that maybe Santa's not going to bring them these things.
Those who do not believe shall not receive?
That's been my mantra right. So far, but I have a fifth grader and a fourth grader, so.
Oh, it's been tougher.
You're in the mode now. Do the kids listen to the podcast?
No, they do not.
Okay, so then we can get that out of the way now, because the issue is whether or not fifth grade is the time when kids talk.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they talk about, not that there's a Santa, because it, newspapers give away toys, but we never say why we're giving stuff.
Yes.
We never say there's a gift. What's the nature of the original gift?
Right.
They can't bring themselves to say it's Jesus Christ, the gift of God to his son
right.
to the world. But that be that as it may, how do you deal with the children talking? There's no Santa.
I don't know. I think we're coming up on that with my fifth grader, but she hasn't really said anything like that. But these technological things that they want, you know, an iPod or something. And I say something like, "Those are $300." And she says, "Well, Santa brings it." And then I'm like, "Oh, right. Well, I'll talk to him about that." So I don't know. It's one of these days. It's probably going to happen. I'll take any advice. Give me your parenting advice. Do I just drop the truth on them at some point? Do I let them kind of figure it out? Will they eventually? I mean, they point blank ask me. I point blank lie pretty much at this point, you know. Well, you know, if you don't believe in Santa, do you think he's not going to bring gifts?
When the boys were that age, we were at Oak Brook Mall. and I went to get them a computer game. It was Age of Empires, which I wanted to play. Because it's all about conquest, yeah, right, Jeff?
Absolutely. Building civilizations.
Build civilizations, and you destroy your opponents and make slaves of them, which is, I think,
or you could be defensive and just defend your realm the entire time. You don't have to go out and...
But you still have to put down slave rebellions, and you do have to get slaves, and you have a choice whether to crucify them or to...
Oh, my gosh. Am I sitting with two Dungeons & Dragons?
No, this is real. These are little... This is a real computer game.
Dungeons & Dragons is actually cooler because it's actually, like, real. Election.
No. The point being, I got them the game, and what do you think, guys? We were sitting at Oak Brook outside, you know, a little mall. And they're like, Dad, we have something to ask you. I'm like, what? And they said, there's no Santa, Dad. We know there's no Santa. That Spiro said, Dad, we know there's no Santa. Peter's like, yeah, we know. No Santa, Dad. I'm like, what? There is a Santa. What are you talking about? And they're like, no, Dad, we know there's no Santa. We know that Christ came down to earth from God as his gift to all mankind, but that's the only gift that really counts. But as far as Santa goes, there's no Santa. We know this now. So you might as well just stop it. And I'm like, really, boys? And they're like, yeah, Dad, no Santa. So I said, well, you're right. There is, you know, Santa was, you know, the bishop and talked about how he was a bishop, St. Nicholas and all that, not Krampus and all that other pagan nonsense, but that he was a bishop and he loved children and he gave gifts, and that's the tradition we carry today, and that's why we get gifts. But you're right, boys. And they were really cool about it.
Really?
And then we got home and we're having lunch, okay, macaroni and cheese, of course, you know, fifth grade. Like, and how was your shopping with Dad? And the boys turned, looked at me, and said, Dad said there's no Santa.
Oh, no.
I think they were in fourth grade.
Oh,
Dad said there's no Santa, Dad.
You were hoodwinked.
And I was just like the biggest loser.
What did Betty say?
They bluffed me.
She beat you with a wooden spoon.
She gave me the look like, your father's mistaken, that kind of thing. It was just terrible.
That was the same look she gave at the Lit Fest when we were on stage.
Oh, yeah.
I bet.
I'm told you had an interesting experience with your nieces and nephews.
Oh, my gosh, that's right. So this is unrelated to the Santa thing. They're in, like, second, third grade, so they're still in on it, but they're hip kids, so eventually they too will catch my parents in a lie about Santa, I'm sure. But my family was doing yard work and out in the yard this weekend. So my brother, his wife, they're two twin boy and girl who are, like, second, third grade. And then the three-year-old, Willem.
Willem is the conqueror.
Right. Yeah. He certainly is. So the story goes that my brother was out front raking leaves, and my sister-in-law was on the roof doing the gutters because she's the smallest person in the family. She's very nimble, so that's her job. So she goes up there, and she's cleaning the gutters.
Oh,
and she's up there, and she looks over her shoulder, and she sees these tiny little hands holding the gutter and a little head pop up. And Willem had climbed a 6-foot folding ladder, so not the long sending ladder, but just a 6-foot folding ladder that was on the deck, that so that Kelly could get up to my sister-in-law. And there he is. And so she freezes because she doesn't want to yell at him and, like, make him panic or startle him. So he just, you know, kind of shudders and falls. So she, Willem, what are you doing up here? And I'm just trying to be very, very calm and kind of walks over.
Willem.
And by the time she got to him, he'd already made his way halfway down the ladder and was ready to, you know, to hang out with Mom again. And that wasn't where the excitement ended. Later, everyone's outside still working. I look around, and Willem is no longer playing in the sandbox, minding himself.
In the defined play area.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Those little turtle sandboxes, you know, with the cover.
Too small for me.
Right. So everyone, no one knows where he is. And his brother comes out and says, everybody has to come inside now and see this. And so they all shuffle in. They go downstairs. Willem, who was three, had gone inside by himself, turned on the Xbox, found his favorite movie, turned it on, pulled up his little Cars chair.
Yeah, a little tiny baby chair.
Yeah, right in front of the TV, and fell asleep with, like, his hand in his pants
oh
and his juice box
God.
Next to him.
What's his favorite movie?
It's great.
I don't know what it is, actually.
So cute.
Yeah.
Little man.
Yeah, he was it was a great moment.
Little recliner.
Can you imagine, though, you're on the roof and you see the kid climbing?
Oh, I would have.
How
I
would you not fall panic. Off yourself? That's what I would do.
Yeah, that's tricky. I'm not great with heights, and so I would not be cleaning our gutters. And if my child was on a ladder, I probably would have been the one to scream and then have to call an ambulance. Yeah.
So that was the excitement this holiday week.
Nice.
The Carlin Homestead.
You always have a little story to tell like that. That's good. I mean, like every family needs. Mm-hmm. Remember Willem when he climbed up?
Yeah, so you know, there was a this weekend. I have a scar on my eye, just right outside of my eyelid, or like the corner of my eye.
The anniversary of Jeff Carlin's wildness.
Right. Well, right? No, this is. So my niece and nephew was like, Uncle Jeff, what's that line on your eye, your face by your eye? I said, oh, that's the time that your dad pushed me off a bed into the headboard and I split my eye open. So we told that story, you know.
Right.
So that's what holidays are all about.
Sure.
But see, here's the deal. For those of you listening, I'm looking at Kristen and Jeff. Jeff tells a story. It's an innocent story. But, his brother pushes him off the bed and smashes his face.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen, not the columnist par excellence, but the mom of Inside Kristen, hears that story. And I could see her mom wheels clicking. You told that story? That's where they're going to do it now. Right? Right?
Yes.
We could watch like Three Stooges at home.
Right.
Because my mom thought we would,
you would imitate.
Take the hammer and crack each other, which probably, you know.
You don't need to give kids ideas. They'll come up with their own. True. Yes.
Well, what about the idea for, bad segue, but bad radio, what can I say? The idea of Christmas coming or holiday. Are we going to have a Christmas war again? Can we do that? Like,
it seems to happen every year, you know.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, I'm not going to get really offended over the use of holidays or versus Christmas. But am I going to use Christmas? Yes, I am. Because that is what we celebrate. That's my faith. That's part of why I have grown more and more disenchanted with Christmas.
Excellent.
Thanksgiving.
You're disenchanted with the commercial aspect.
Yes, with
right.
every aspect of it, John. I mean,
Well, not every.
I mean, but the fact that the focus has gone so far off of the birth of Jesus Christ and you know, kind of the humble beginnings of.
Now it's Black Friday where people are fighting.
I mean, people are being stampeded to death.
Right?
It is insane. Mm-hmm. And because of the global economy now, you can get so many more toys for cheaper. So I find myself on December 23rd disappearing into Toys R Us, yanking things off of shelves just so my kids have something to open. Just so they can have more stuff, something with batteries.
As opposed to like a tiny little wood like device with a ball and like, you know, in witness, like something like that. Like, I don't know why the kid wanted to play with that thing, but you put a ball and it rolls around.
Right.
Through, something like that. Right.
Right.
Like some wooden duck. Like, here's your wooden duck. Oh, thank you, Father.
Yes.
Like
no, it, oh. I am going to scale back. I have hesitated to ask my family members to scale back because my mother is one of those people who truly gets so much joy out of watching her grandkids rip open a million presents.
And you freak out and think,
I don't say anything, but we go to one house, we come home, I have to redo the whole house to make room for stuff. We have a very small little south side home. There's no room for extra crapola.
You mean the crapola that breaks in 2 days? It's all
right. Or they don't play with. Or so I'm just, and I don't like to shop. So the idea of going to the mall or something like that. Yeah. So I'm a bah humbug person.
Jeff's the other way. He's like the spoil uncle way, like the spoiling the kids. Right? Come on, admit it.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You're a total spoiler.
Yeah. I try to give them the coolest gift ever, whatever it is this year. I haven't figured that out yet, but
it's 4 in. Morning, the end of December. I'm writing you now just to see if you're better. New York is cold, but I like where I'm living. There's music on Clinton Street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your little house deep in the desert. You're living for nothing now. I hope you're keeping.
Like, okay, is a 10-year-old too young to get like an Xbox game that involves an apocalyptic New York where you have to kill the crazy, you know, raiders who try to destroy civilization?
I mean, I would
10? Yeah, I think that's
it's called the Division. So
that's the name of the game.
Yeah, I might have to play it just to work on it to see if it's okay.
Okay. Well, my son plays Star Wars games, and I thought those would be pretty innocent. there's a lot of blow me up stuff in those too.
Right. So
not
what
crazy
they
about
play
those.
With,
well, I mean, I kind of liked the Wii. It was just sports and basketball and
Wii, no.
No, it's you can't play.
Boys
that
don't like Wii. Oh. Let's just admit it. I
really?
Went through the boy thing.
Yeah.
Wii, no.
Go kart or Mario Kart that's on Wii. That's pretty sweet. That's
you like to play it.
Mario Kart, yeah.
I mean, I know
boys
a lot of
want
people
to play shoot games, okay, and war games. They want to be boys. Like Christina, I think we need to have Christina Hoff Summers into the editorial board.
Who is that?
Christina Hoff Summers is a woman who writes, she's a PhD, studies the war on boys. She's written a book, The War
okay.
on Boys.
Okay, so she would defend them being able to play.
Well, she would talk about
games.
How boys are wired differently than girls,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Oh, I would agree with that. I mean, my daughter has no interest in a lot of these video games. And I guess I've gotten to a point where I try to make sure he's not seeing anything that's super graphic or adult oriented or, you know.
No breasts.
No.
But why is it okay?
No breasts.
All right, here. Okay, in PG. No breasts, PG movies. No breasts, no sex, but kills.
Right.
Kills are okay, but breasts and sex, started. Not okay.
We actually, I'm probably going to get so much criticism, but I'm going to say it anyway. I sat down with my kids and let them watch Cujo because they wanted to watch a scary house.
Because they wanted a dog, and you said, here's the one.
No, we actually have a little tiny fluffy dog.
Okay.
They like to watch scary movies that they, you know, Goosebumps and some of these that are appropriate for kids. And it was around Halloween time, and it was either like Chucky or Friday. You know, it's all these scary murder type things.
No.
Or Cujo, which I sat with them the whole time. I explained the movie. It's very well done. The acting is great. It's Stephen King.
The end of it is the part that you're like,
That's with Lance Hendrickson, Cujo, right?
Lance Hendrickson?
The dad or something?
Sure.
I don't know. What's I just know it was the mom from E.T.
Right.
It's just very well directed.
Like
and we tried to kind of.
What happened to her?
I don't know.
She didn't get a big, you know.
she had a couple
mom.
Hit movies and then she sort of filtered out. But they were not traumatized by it. They, you know, I'm sure they've talked about it with their friends since, but I would rather they actually watch a show like that than some of the Disney back and forth materialistic cool kids. You have to wear the right clothes.
Yeah. Princess Bride. That's a good kids movie.
That is a great movie.
They have seen that.
How about the Neverending Story?
Yes,
Atreyu.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, we've seen that.
Right?
My brother let his kids watch Ghostbusters when they were like five, six, which I thought was too young. I mean, they swear in it, but
well, there's some nudity and things in that too.
I mean, it's like PG-13.
Sigourney
see what
Weaver.
I'm doing? I'm like, there's some nudity.
Sigourney Weaver.
Right.
Yes, when she gets all crazed.
And playing a sexy creature.
Right.
Which is weird enough for her. But right?
Yeah.
Go back to fighting the aliens, okay?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
That's another good movie for children.
Yeah.
No?
I saw that at a sleepover when I was in like fourth
grade.
Which
one? Aliens?
Aliens.
Okay.
And from that point on, I couldn't eat like the ham that came out of an Egg McMuffin because it was like the dad went out and like brought back Egg McMuffin. And I'm like eating it and like all these things are happening. Like, just like the flavor, the taste. And the imagery.
So have you eaten one since?
No.
Wow.
It ruined it for me.
I did take the kids to a cartoon when they were little, thinking it's a cartoon, like a sci-fi cartoon.
Right.
I thought it was good. Yeah. Titan AE it was called.
Oh, yeah?
And the dad gets killed in the first, 4 minutes. And they were screaming, the daddy dies. And they were crying.
Yeah. You know what my dad took
daddy
us
dies.
To?
Bambi.
The Blue Lagoon.
Oh.
At a very young age. Exactly.
If I watched the Blue Lagoon, Betty would like crack me in the back of the head right now.
He thought, I think he didn't do his research. I'm sure this was way in the old days.
Children.
Kids on an island.
Nature.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I had a lot of questions after that movie.
Where does the baby come from?
Right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. He tells that story how he was sitting in the theater just wanting to absolutely melt into his chair.
My brother-in-law, Ed, took his 90-year-old mom to a movie called True. He thought it was True Romance, Mom.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, yeah, that'll be good. Romance, New York, you know, not hookers and drug lords. And
it's a great movie, but
it's a great movie.
Automatic Weapons. Yeah,
automatic
that's not a good
weapons.
One.
We should come up with our, okay, let's think for the next time we're together. Come up with a holiday gift idea movie/movie thing.
Okay.
Because people are going to be around the house.
Yes.
I think you should only give one gift per kid, and it should be a special gift, usually with old technology involving paper and print.
Here's your Tribune, kids.
Here's your Trib.
Merry Christmas.
Here's Mr. Cass's column for the last 20 years in a big stack of yellowed clips, you know?
They would love it.
Oh, yeah, that would be so exciting. My kids just started reading the, you know, they're in college, and they're like, hey, Dad, read your column. I'm like, wow, okay, cool. I made it.
They're finally reading you.
Right? Wait till they start reading you. Wait till that happens.
Oh, well.
My teacher said.
Right, exactly. My teacher said she's wrong about everything. Yeah, I get that a lot.
Nothing that lives in the imagination is more frightening than the terror that lives in Castle Rock, Maine.
Cujo?
Cujo?
Can he get us in here?
Oh my God, I'm losing my baby.
From the novel by Stephen King, creator of Carrie and The Shining, comes a startling vision of fear.
Please, God, get me out of here.
Now there's a new name for terror. Cujo.
One of the best reporters in the country is my friend and Tribune journalist Gary Marks. With David Jackson, these two have done incredible work that has prompted congressional hearings, law enforcement indictments, and reform. But Gary Marks is also a former foreign correspondent covering wars, having worked in Africa and Latin America. And years ago, he opened the Chicago Tribune's bureau in Cuba. That's right, Castro's Cuba. His reporting was even-handed, and Castro liked the fact that his name was Marks. But even-handed reporting is a way of angering dictators. And I want you to hear Gary Marks tell it himself.
And the stories that you did, Gary, were, I would say, balanced. It wasn't, you didn't go in there like a National Review Cuban exile, you know, hitting Cuba for everything they had. You had many different balanced and nuanced stories about the people of Cuba, the difficulties they faced, ham-handed attempts by the United States government to overthrow the regime or to entice doctors out of the country, and still you were kicked out. So here we have Gary Marks. Hello, Gary.
Hey, John.
So tell me about Cuba.
You know, it is such a difficult place to describe and such a difficult place to work. I was one of the few Western correspondents based there. I was there from 2002 to 2007. Before, as you said, they pulled my press credential and said, you're out of here, basically. I think the thing you have to understand is it is a police state. It is an authoritarian government. And really, there is no dissent. What dissent exists on the island is, for the most part, kind of corralled. And there are incredibly brave people on the island who have tried to create spaces in civil society, tried to push back against the government. But their lives are incredibly difficult, and most of them in the end end up leaving the island and are forced into exile into the United States or to Spain or someplace like that.
One of our colleagues, Metropolitan editor Mark Jacob, when I told him I was going to have you on the podcast, he mentioned that he had been there recently with his wife to Cuba, and she noticed that there were no boats along the river along the waterfront. Where were the boats, he said. I said, well, I would assume that you don't want boats there because people get in and leave.
Yeah. I mean, well, obviously you've had tens of thousands of Cubans who've left over the years, and they've risked their lives, and many, unfortunately, have died at sea trying to get to the United States. You know, again, for me, just to give the readers and the listeners an understanding of what it's like, I mean, I essentially was under surveillance all the time, 24/7. I just assumed.
And your family.
Yes, and my family. My late wife and my kids were there at the time.
Cecile was a baseman, was also a journalist as well.
She was, but she was not given press credentials by the Cuban government, so she could not work as a journalist while I was there. But she was incredibly helpful to me in terms of developing stories and understanding the place. She was from Argentina and obviously was fluent Spanish speaker and really understood Cuba in a way that was difficult for me as an outsider, always being watched to do. But it was, go ahead, John.
But you had, given the, so people understand this, you didn't just cover, you know, the second Area 2 violent crimes and then go over to Cuba. You had spent time in West Africa and other places as well. So you understood the fact that foreign nationals and reporters are often under surveillance, but this must have been ratcheted up.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, I've covered wars, and I spent more than a decade overseas in Latin America and in Africa, and had seen really bad stuff and reported under tremendously difficult conditions, including, again, covering wars. But this was different. You know, this was a police state where you're being watched all the time. And, you know, when people ask me what it's like, I sort of talk to them. I sort of refer them to that great movie, The Lives of Others. You know, the movie about, I think it was about East Germany, mm-hmm. and about people living in East Germany at the time. And, you know, it really gets into your head when you know your phones are bugged and your emails are being read and your house is bugged, and that the employees you have in your office, which you have to hire through the government, are informants on you. It really presses against your mind. It really becomes claustrophobic in a way that people who've never lived in a society like that don't understand.
And still there were brave people who were willing to speak out at least somewhat before they themselves were jailed or had to leave.
Absolutely. But as a reporter, you know, what I had to do was build a sort of a circle of confidence. I really did. And it took many years to do that, even though, you know, I was reporting all the time. You know, when you see on the phone, on the TV now, and in news, you know, on TV, you see people being interviewed on the street about what they think of Fidel, et cetera, et cetera. You know, frankly, I wouldn't believe a word that they're saying. People who are on the TV, you know, they know the BBC or, you know, which I love or right. whatever. I mean, people who are on camera, for the most part, aren't telling you what they really think. They're telling you what they think you want to hear for one reason or another. And I learned this very quickly in Havana. Hardly ever would I quote people on the street about an important story that if I didn't know them. I built sort of a circle of people that I, in all walks of life, that I trusted. They trusted me, and only then would I sort of get a real feel for what people are thinking.
And those people themselves were under surveillance as well, I would assume, correct?
You know, I had more than one incident where people who I interviewed came up to me afterwards and said state security had stopped by their house and wanted to know what we had talked about and essentially wanted to turn them into an informant. And I frankly had the Cuban government talk to me after, you know, a number of years saying, you know, and I was on their blacklist for a long time because, you know, I wasn't a fellow traveler. And as you said, I worked really hard to come in there with no preconceived notions. I really did.
But you don't do that with any of the stories you write. You don't go in there with an agenda, which I find that many people who scream the media, including me, because I've used that phrase, should understand. There are many journalists who go places or even here in the city that don't go in with a political agenda, and you had none.
Yeah. And I mean, in Cuba, it was just as we all know, it's a lightning rod. It's a lightning rod for the left. It's a lightning rod for the right. I'd spent a lot of time in Latin America, but I'd only been to Cuba once before I was posted there in 2002. And I went there sort of with an open mind. I really did. And I tried to really get deep into the place and write about what people's lives were like. And of course, that had to do with human rights, and the Cuban government just didn't like that.
Before we go into some of the history of what happened there, I must ask you, I watched some of the Useful Idiots talking, Pierre Trudeau and others, and then I saw something from Andrea Mitchell, which I thought, okay, typical, right?
Greenspan.
Mrs. Greenspan, as we call her, queen of the establishment, and she was saying something like, well, Fidel Castro, you know, she interviewed a woman on the street in Cuba who was crying,
kind of like she could have been crying in North Korea after the death of that dictator, but she was here in Cuba crying. And then she said, but he was such a fascinating man who would stay up at all hours talking about literature and politics. It was very, and I'm trying to get the sense of what is it with the butt-kissing of Fidel?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's talk about it from both sides.
Yeah.
On the one hand, Fidel put Cuba on the map. He did. Cubans are incredibly proud people, and they are very well-educated. And Cuba put Fidel put Cuba on the map. He defied the United States. He helped bring down the apartheid government in South Africa and helped free, you know, Angola of, you know, colonial rule.
And sent soldiers and
he did. And Cubans died in Angola to fight back the South Africans. And so, you know, and in his own country, you know, he did, with the help of the former Soviet Union, create a healthcare system that for a long time worked and an education system. And you got to give him credit for that. And many older Cubans are proud of that. But, you know, that stuff, the great part of the revolution in many ways ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 89. And when Gorbachev pulled the plug on billions of dollars in aid annually to Cuba, that country has gone downhill and it really hasn't worked since. And people have basically voted with their legs. You know, they've left the country. Young people, most young people who can leave Cuba. They really do, because there hasn't been a future for them. There hasn't been a way for them to fulfill their dreams. And that's what this government has done more than anything else. It has killed the dreams of many Cubans and forced them to leave the country when they don't want to. It is their homeland. They love the place. There's so much great about it. This government has killed their dreams.
And what about the repression? What about the repression, the tortures, the executions, the gulag that he created, an island prison in the middle of the Caribbean?
Yeah, I mean, most of the executions took place right after the revolution. And but, you know, as I said earlier, you know, it's, you know, you're not going to be executed in Cuba if you dissent against the government. Now, there hasn't been an execution in a while. But what happened is, you know, your child is not going to get into a good government school. You know, you're going to lose your government job. You know, you are going to have pressure on you. You may be incarcerated. You may be, you know, harassed by the police all the time. You know, your life is made to be very, very difficult if you speak out against the government, if you speak out against Raul Castro, if you speak out against Fidel. There are going to be repercussions for
even
you.
Even
today.
So the as Cuba lost its patronage, and, you know, Thatcher's famous comment, socialism is great until you run out of the money, of other people's money. We've noticed that President Obama went to Cuba, tried to open it up. I'm sure the Pritzkers and other hotel companies are happy from the United States to do work there. Who will be the beneficiaries of this new Cuba? I would suggest it would be the, just like Soviet Union became Russia, the KGB and intelligence operatives who were tied into all different parts of the establishment were the ones who rose up economically because they had the information and the leverage. I would assume the same thing is going to happen in Cuba. Is that crazy?
Well, they control the levers of power. I mean, Raul, and again, I have to say, I haven't been back to Cuba since 2010. It's been a while. But Raul, you know, when he took power essentially for good in 2008, when Fidel was ill and stepped aside, since then, he's put in most of his loyalists. And those are former military people, former generals, and they control a majority of the economy right now. They are the political and economic elite. So are they the ones who are going to benefit from this opening? Yes, they will. The question is, John, and I don't have the answer for you. You know, the question is, will opening up the economy, will it trickle down to the average person on the street? Now, they have allowed some small private businesses. Fidel allowed this after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they lost those billions. But when the Venezuelans stepped in and Hugo Chavez stepped in with 100,000 or 150,000 gallons of, barrels of free oil, then they sort of clamp down on those people. So they open up when they need to, and they clamp down when they don't need to. Right now, Venezuela is in big trouble, yes, as we know.
Right.
That economy is collapsing.
Not even toilet paper. They're starving.
Yeah. I mean, and people are leaving.
Right.
There was a great story in the newspaper, in the New York Times this weekend about Venezuelans fleeing by the tens of thousands. So, you know, the question is, are they going to open up more? Is there leverage to open up more? Who will benefit? But the levers of power right now are still in the hands of the military elite and of the political elite.
What about you personally? I was struck by your story about being the feeling of being constantly under surveillance. What was it like personally for you to be there? And what happened? Were you jailed like I was told?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't use the word jailed, but I was detained many times. And so what would happen is I would go into a small village. I was doing a story in the countryside. I would go into a small village, and I knew that I had probably about 1 hour, a golden hour, so to speak, where I could interview people.
Before
somebody on the street called the police, called the intelligence services, and then I would be brought, then they would make a huge sort of show.
Really?
Yes. And I would be brought, you know, they'd take me away.
One car
and,
or two?
You know, whatever. Two. Three. But whatever. Yeah. You're in a small village. The right. police show up. People are really scared. And you know, they would take me in, and they were very nice. I had my press credentials. They would ask me what's in my notebook. They couldn't read English. My handwriting is, you know, scribble.
Legendary scribbles.
Exactly. Okay. And so, you know, I said, I'm here legally. Here's my press credential. Call up the foreign ministry. They know I'm here. You know, and then they would release me after an hour or 2 hours or something like that. But my day of reporting in that town was over. Nobody would talk to me really after that. And this happened over and over again. It happened on the day Fidel got ill and I went out into the plaza to interview people. I actually had forgotten my press credentials up in my office.
Yeah.
I stepped right outside and, you know, they took me away and held me for 4 or 5 hours. They were very nice.
Did they offer soda or snacks?
No soda or snacks. But, you know, it wasn't like I ever felt physically threatened. Never, you know. But they sort of made my job incredibly difficult.
And then you were kicked out of the country.
Yes. Well, they pulled my press credential and said I couldn't work there anymore. And, you know, if I can't work anymore there, I gotta leave the country. But
and
again,
what was your great sin? Because you were doing stuff at that time about the United States government with these ridiculous. Let's put it this way: whenever you start a federal program, it gets really huge.
Yeah,
and it turned like let's get rid of Castro turned into stereos and video games going to Cubans in Miami. Explain
that. Well, this was a State Department program that that essentially was you know. Spending, I forget what it is now, tens of millions of dollars a year to supposedly provide aid to the dissidents.
Right.
And, you know, of course, some of the dissidents turned out to be government agents. Some were incredibly brave people who were actually trying to write stuff and send it to Miami to get it published to try to, you know, show people outside of Cuba, because Cubans inside can't read these websites, of course. Many don't have access to the internet. Tell them what's going on in the country. So I wrote about that. I wrote about the, you know, the waste and the fraud about that. And I tried to be really on both sides. Yes, I tried to be very balanced. But they, you know, I wrote one story, I think, that was sort of what I heard later. And I'll tell the story briefly. So I wrote a story about it was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the FAR, the Revolutionary Armed Forces. And I remember this was after Fidel had been sick and had temporarily ceded power in 2006 to his brother, Raul, and Raul hadn't appeared in public. Fidel turned over power in July 2006. This was December of 2006, and Raul had never appeared in public, never said what he was going to do to the, you know, Cuban people. And then they were going to hold this huge march, which they did with tanks and artillery.
Right.
And I wrote a story, you know, the day, you know, that it was published the day of that thing, saying, you know, Cubans, and this is true, Cubans didn't want to see tanks. They didn't want to see this march. They wanted to know how Raul Castro was going to improve their lives economically. That's what they wanted. And I remember the headline of the story, which I did not write, as you know, John.
Blaming the copy editor once again.
It was a great headline.
Right.
It said, "The parade is a charade."
Oh, well, I'm sure he wasn't happy with that.
And I remember that I got to the parade. I went to it. You know, I had to check in with the foreign ministry. And I remember the guy who handled the foreign press, I saw him, he would not even shake my hand. And for Cubans, that is the biggest insult you can do in Latin America. You know, even people you disagree with,
look a man in the eye.
You look a man in the eye, you say, how are you? You say, how's your family? How are your kids?
Right.
That's the way Cubans are.
Right.
And he didn't shake my hand. He didn't. He looked at me for a second, and I sort of knew that that was the beginning of the end for me.
That's a big difference from the story that I'd read recently, where Fidel himself was reading a story you had written in the Chicago Tribune. I think it was about a dissident in Miami, and this is the quote. Of course, it's not that I read The Nation all the time. I read The Nation so you don't have to, but the quote is, here's Fidel reading a story from the Tribune. In reality, and then he looks at the byline, in reality, I give thanks to the reporter, Gary Ma. Then he hesitated. Then he continued with surprise in his voice. His name is Marx. Compadre, even more respect for the reporter. His name is Gary Marx, and in reality, this newspaper is an organ that tries to say some things.
Yeah. Well, that was it.
Did you say, yeah, my great-grandfather was Karl Marx, just to get into it?
Well, the interesting thing is that, Fidel said this on national TV, and and up to that point, I knew that I was really, I couldn't get any interviews with government officials. It was very difficult. They knew I wasn't sort of a fellow traveler, but I felt like I was reporting.
Clearly you're not, since I know you.
Right.
You're not.
Tough but fair.
Gary's one of the few people at the Tribune that'll actually talk to me.
Yeah.
All right.
So the funny thing is the foreign ministry, I was on, obviously, their blacklist and couldn't get interviews. And so Fidel gets on TV and he's reading all the foreign press coverage of it. This guy wasn't an activist. The guy I wrote about was a terrorist, a former CIA operative who had been accused and was probably responsible for bringing down a Cuban airliner in the 1970s that killed
the Nation,
200 people.
Okay,
or so
the Nation called him a terrorist, so I didn't know what to say.
Yeah, no, he was.
Right,
and,
okay, he was a terrorist.
And so this guy shows up in Miami. His name is Luis Posadas Carriles and says he wants political asylum. I don't want to get into the whole story, but I flew immediately to Miami because this guy held a small press conference, and I interviewed the guy. I wrote a straight news story, and then Fidel, of course, this is in 2003. Fidel is in a rage because he's saying George Bush is talking about the war on terrorism in Iraq, and they're invading. And here is a guy who's a terrorist who brought down an airliner, and he's asking for political asylum in the U.S. So I wrote a straight story, including in the story I quoted this guy's attorney saying that Fidel Castro es un tirano. Fidel Castro is a tyrant. So Fidel is on TV for 5 days in a row. Of course, it's all state controlled.
Right.
Railing
no commercials.
No commercials.
Right.
It's just Fidel 24/7. So he's on and he's reading all the foreign media and he gets to my story, which was second. And I'm in my office at 9 at night. Listen to this. I call my wife. I say, get ready, sweetheart. Turn on the TV because we may be kicked out tonight. And so he begins reading the story. And I think he reads the lead and he says, this guy, it's a pretty good lead.
Right.
And Fidel comments about everything.
Right.
And so it takes him an hour and a half to read the thing. In fact, he's on live TV in front of all these generals and all these Communist Party officials. And he even reads the quote that says, Fidel Castro es un tirano, is a tyrant. And he starts laughing. And of course, the camera pans to the generals who are sitting in the audience, like 300 people in uniforms, and nobody even moves. They're petrified.
They don't know whether to laugh.
Exactly.
Right, because they know they've been killed.
Keep their mouths shut.
Right,
and so he ends up going through the story, and at the end he says, a pretty good story. And then he says what you wrote.
Gary Marx.
Right. And the kicker to this is that the next day at 7 a.m., I get a call from the Cuban foreign ministry, the official who's responsible for the foreign press, who said literally the first words were, can we be friends?
Mr. Marx.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Because, right. So I got the endorsement of the comandante.
And you went to see him?
I went to see him.
Did he shake your hand?
And I said to the guy, he said, what can we do for you? And I gave him a list of the 10 interviews with government officials I had not gotten. And he also said to me, what can we do for your wife? We know she doesn't have a press credential. What can we do for your children? I said, you can do nothing for me.
Right, right.
But here are, because I knew the room was wired with a camera.
Sure.
And
Said, if you go in the mayor's office and ask something for your family, it's wired too.
Ron plays hardball.
Right,
I know that.
Right.
And I said, no, but here are the 10 interviews I couldn't get Can you get me these interviews, including one with Fidel? Didn't get me the interviews, but it turns out I later learned that Fidel's comment on TV, you know, bought me another 2 or 3 years in the country.
I made a joke about the Karl Marx thing, and so did Fidel Castro. But are you related to Karl Marx?
I am. I'm not related to Karl Marx, okay. even though my daughter, who's in college, wishes we were, because it's very cool. She goes to one of those liberal leading colleges in the East Coast.
Yes, I know about them, and I'm on guard, but that's okay. Okay, the children they have to fly and then come back home. Okay, that's how it works.
I get it.
Also, you know, one thing I have to mention about your stay there. What about sport? You wrote stuff on baseball. You wrote stuff on sport as well.
Yeah, and in fact, I wrote one of my favorites. Yes, I love boxing, and of course, you know, Cuba is known for boxing and for baseball, and of course, I was really interested in the Soviet or East German sort of system and how it was grafted onto Cuba, and you know they have tremendous athletes. So I wrote stories. One story was about Teofilo Stevenson, the great Cuban boxer. And you remember him. He was,
heavyweight champion.
He was the Olympic gold medalist.
Right,
two
but he
or
was
three
also
times
the
over.
World heavyweight champion, the amateur boxer. He was the amateur champion of the world.
Right.
And he never fought professionally.
Correct. And that was the big question. And that, you know, I found this guy and, you know, the big, and I wanted to sort of find out, you know, what happens to old Soviet sports heroes. And, and the big question, of course, for boxing fans is, could he have beaten Muhammad Ali? And
no.
And so, you know, no. Well, that's what Angelo Dundee said when I reached him,
right.
the late great trainer. But, you know, again, I found this guy and, you know, he was, I got to say, a very interesting person. He was also a heavy drinker and, you know, kind of a womanizer. And he was also hitting me up for money. And, you know, of
Stevenson.
Course, Stevenson was.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, I put that in the story.
Yeah.
You know, I just said, and that wasn't the big part of the story, but... You know, when we
would you expect a warrior priest for communism?
It's
like sleeping on a Spartan cot.
Exactly.
Oh, I can't wait for my next opponent.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, and I tried, you know, so of course the story ran and that wasn't a big part of it. This guy's an incredible human being and a great figure and stuff like that. But I put that in there. And of course, you know, I get the call
from
the foreign ministry, the Cuban government. You know, what are you doing, you know, slandering our great hero, our great sports hero? And I just said, listen, you know, in the Western media, you know, our sports heroes are human beings with their flaws and their strengths. And I said, you know, that is my job as a reporter. I'm going to tell it like it is. And this is who Teofilo Stevenson is. But they just didn't get it. They didn't understand that.
Gary Marks. Thanks for being here with us today. Gary, glad you're back in the United States, and we'll talk soon, okay?
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure.
Jeff Carlin is always on me to tell stories, and he wanted me to tell this story during the Gary Marks interview, but I saved it and worked it into a column the other day. It, too, is about Castro, but with so many useful idiots tweeting and writing his praises, we forget that some people just don't tweet. A guy like Luis wouldn't tweet. He was a Cuban I knew years ago, big and brutal, kind of like a heavyweight boxer, old and broken by Castro's prison. He was a member of my crew when I was a 19-year-old kid thinking I was a man, seeing the world as a sailor on an old rusty merchant cargo ship, the HMV Poseidon. There were Spaniards and Greeks on our crew, Egyptians, Sudanese, Iranians, Iraqis, and one Cuban. Luis. Luis was a policeman in Havana before Castro's revolution, and after the revolution, they threw him in prison. At least they didn't execute him. And on the Poseidon, he helped the cook. He cleaned the galleys, he peeled the potatoes, he cleaned the commodes, he made the coffee, and generally he kept to himself. And we kind of liked it that way, because Luis could be happy one day and mean the next. And we kept away from him in his pineapple-sized fists, but we always watched him. But one day, on a voyage between New Orleans and the British Guiana and the muddy Demerara River, our ship lost power. They radioed in for parts, and we drifted for a day and then another in the big water coming close to Cuba and the lights of Havana.
It was then that Luis became terrified. He was afraid that if we drifted into Cuban waters, the Cuban patrols would take him, and he wanted to kill himself rather than go back. So we stood with him, drinking rum in the bow, out on the deck, the boat drifting, the stars overhead, and the moon, and the water, so oily. That's what happens when water is calm in the ocean. You can see it like oil everywhere you look when the lights go out, and then it's gone. And I could see what the fear did to him. The thoughts of the Cuban prison. The gulag from Castro just a few miles away, waiting to welcome him home. This wasn't like fear in a movie. This wasn't dramatic. It was quiet, like some silent animal on the inside of the man, devouring him. But Luis was lucky. On the second day, the parts came by helicopter. The engineers got the boat going, and we began to putter away from Cuban waters. We could see the lights of Havana. Luis leaned over the side and began to sob. We picked up speed, and soon the dolphins were running with the ship, breaking out of the smooth, tense water at the bow, as is their way, the ship cutting through that calm, black, oily sea. There were no tweets in those days. There was no social media. The useful idiot politicians of the left who would praise the murderous Castro this week didn't even have cell phones. So Luis didn't have to read or hear them chattering or tweeting. And if he's alive today, which I doubt, I don't think he'd tweet. Back then, Luis looked up with Havana to starboard, the lights of the city glowing in the sky, the tears on his face. He was gulping for air. Please join us again for another edition of The Chicago Way with John Cass and Jeff Carlin. Thanks, everybody.